Welcome to World Anti-Extremism Network's scholarly podcast on ideas for countering extremism and authoritarianism. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the World Anti-Extremism Network's podcast. I'm your host, Ahrar Ramizpour. Thank you for joining us. Today, we are diving into crucial topic, law, authoritarianism, and extremism. As many of you know, authoritarianism is marked by strong centralized power, limited political pluralism in the suppression of dissent, often through harsh restrictions on individual freedoms. Authoritarianism takes it a step further, where the state seeks control nearly every aspect of both public in private life. Authoritarian regimes frequently exploit legal systems, policy tools, and even legislative bodies to tighten their grip on society, shrinking civic space and silencing freedom. To explore this further, I'm honored to be joined by Professor Fridyun Rahmani as part of our ongoing series on authoritarian and totalitarian regimes and their impact on freedom. Professor Rahmani is a distinguished academic with extensive experience in higher education and international research. His expertise spans Middle East studies, war-affected societies, political violence, human rights, displacement and migration, international relations, social demography, and leadership, and also applied policy research. Welcome to WEN's podcast, Professor Rahmani. Without further delay, I would like to start with my first question. How do authoritarian regimes manipulate or redefine legal systems to consolidate power? Please, Dr. Rahmani, floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Professor Ramizpour, for inviting me on this podcast. Actually, the authoritarian regimes often use legal systems as instruments of control rather than laws for justice and human rights. The authoritarian systems, the despotic societies, they start with the rule by law and not rule of law. The whole concept and philosophy behind the authoritarianism is to control and use the systems of surveillance to control the entire society based on their frameworks of ideology or religious structures. I always tell my students that there are differences between the authoritarianism and despotic systems. Authoritarian systems, normally, they use the bureaucratic and technological spaces for rather economic development by controlling the mind and political activism of their population. But in despotic systems, the mind and the thought is also completely controlled to make complete subordinations of the entire population, even ideological, even thinking, even the culture. So there is always unclarity and vague understanding of the laws and systems. The laws that are vague, they are completely interpreted based on the wish and desires of the authoritarian and despotic systems, unfortunately. They always use the politicized judiciary. Appointments are also based on their ideology. Judges, the lawyers, the legal systems is completely controlled by such philosophy of politicization. They use the emergency decrees. They use the constitutional amendments back and forth to rather crack down on dissents and centralizing their authority. We have seen this in Egypt in 2013 when counterterrorism laws were introduced. We have seen it in 2016 when Erdogan used the emergency situation to crack down on thousands of not even the political dissent, but rather the administrative, normal civil society organizations. We have seen it in many other countries. Unfortunately, in countries like Iran, the authoritarianism, or rather despotism, becomes a mixture of ideology and religion. The people are cracked down not only for political dissent, but rather because of enmity against God. Because based on the Iranian regime or other Islamic Republic systems in the Middle East, the source of legalization is based on the God sovereignty, is not based on people's participation and people's decision. The laws are rather top-down and is kind of mixed with layers of control and surveillance. Appointments are not the legal appointment or security appointments or higher ranking positions appointments. They are rather based on kind of a commitment of the person to the system and not based on their appropriation or based on their professionalism and abilities.
Thank you, Dr. Friedman. Really, you described this topic very clearly, and you illustrated your points with very clear examples from Egypt to Turkey to Iran, and I would like to add also Russia, maybe other parts of the world. Thank you so much for this. If you describe a little bit the distinguish between the differences in the legal systems in totalitarian and authoritarian regimes, democratic society, what are the key points that distinguish to differentiate between these two systems?
First of all, I have to say that we don't have a really sophisticated, best, high degree of human rights respect anywhere around the world. Everywhere we see around the world, even Western liberal societies, violation of rights and human rights abuses, unfortunately. So we don't have a 100% perfect society, but we can generally divide the societies between the liberal democracies, liberal Western democracies, and less democratized societies, and despotic authoritarian societies like Iran, Turkey, Iraq, Afghanistan, and many other countries in the region. The majority of the democratic liberal societies, they are based on the democratic elections, bottom-up review of the laws, creation of the law. While in non-liberal, non-democratic societies, or even further, if we go deeper in despotic systems, we see rather an elite making the laws, making the decisions. It's highly controlled, preserved system of lawmaking. It's a top-down, not even the formally appointed members as a member of parliament in the main legislation can make the real laws, because there are layers of control for even those decrees and laws passed through that institutions. Unfortunately, the division of power, which was mentioned a few hundred years ago by Montesquieu, is not in reality practice. The division of power is not there. Rather, is controlling of those legislative, executive, and judiciary powers. They are controlled by a small elite, and those are the elites. They are controlling the system. I remember one of the Italian sociologists, Wilfredo Pareto, once was talking that the history is graveyard of elites, and always in the political systems, especially in the developing countries and dictatorial regimes, we see the elites coming to power, they control, they perish, and then next elite coming to the power. So he's talking, Wilfredo Pareto is talking about the cycle of elite or circulation of elite. Unfortunately, in despotic systems or in authoritarian regimes, always an elite comes and the next elite is coming to the power. And in this equation, civic society, normal citizens, and public is not completely involved, and they put completely on the side. And in democratic system, there is a rather more transparency, not only in lawmaking, but even in implementation of laws. There is a check and balance system. They're back and forth checking if they have done something wrong. Let's do it again. Let's amend it. Let's make it more professional. And the laws are based on participatory lawmaking system. So it's a huge differences, but these are the generally which it comes from my mind.
Thank you, Professor. Check and balance, transparency, accountability, respect to human rights, all of these things are key points in the democratic system, in contrary to those totalitarian and authoritarian regimes. Let's focus a little bit, Professor Friedun, on those Islamic countries that apparently they have constitution. If you look to the 75 members of OIC, more than 50 countries have constitutions. I had personally a short research in 2011, and I had a look on some of the constitutions of these countries like Syria, Libya, and other personal rights or individual rights. It was described in all of these constitutions, apparently transit. But in practice, if you look deeply to the history of these countries, always there have been suppressing policy by the government towards civilians. Why these societies, all these individuals' freedoms, access to justice or other sort of civil and political rights in these kind of institutions, but they are not practicing in practice? In that was the main cause for this Arab Spring, when we have seen after 2011 a number of uprisals in these countries. What do you think? Why they are in principle ratifying or putting these values in the constitution, but in practice they are different? Also, if you collaborate a little bit about the justification of the authoritarian regimes about suppression against society, why they justify, how they justify only national security, national interest, or these kind of arguments are enough for arguing about the violence they are committing?
Unfortunately, in global south and in authoritarian systems, especially in the Middle East, there are paradoxes which I see. The people are completely in control of the elites. They are in control of the resources. And to continue controlling those resources, they have to control the mind of the people. And these paradoxes makes the people dual standards. They have one way of life in the internal personal networkings, while in the public, they show different mentality, different way of life. And this has created by the spread of fear, abuse, and violence by the regime. The regimes, they want to play with the people's mind, to control them, to have them the limited access to decision-making, limited planning for their futures. The culture is controlled by the same understanding and philosophy of control and abuse. The people are put in jail in the name of national security issues, enmity with God, enmity with the state, or being a foreign agents of foreign countries. But these are kind of a rather delegitimizing the opposition, putting them as forefront foreign agents or even terrorist agents. Hannah Arendt was explaining that the authoritarian systems always tries to delegitimize the civic society, delegitimize the normal citizens, making the normal citizens as an enemy. And this is the way nowadays we see it in the Middle East. You see the normal citizens for having a picture, saying some simple word, or even protesting for access to having a water, is put in jail, or an environmentalist, as someone he is trying to protect its environment around himself or around its town, is put in jail for just making sure they are not doing anything what can go one step further, become a social movement, a protest or opposition toward the system. It's full control. So under the pretext of combating terrorists in Turkey, 150,000 people in 2016, they were cracked down, a tens of thousands, they were put in jail and sent to courts. And still people like Selahattin Demirtas, one of the Kurdish oppositional leaders, who has been for years using all the democratic abilities within the Turkish political system, become a voice of the voiceless, but has shut down and put in jail within proper access to lawmaking, lawyers, and access to judges. They always frame the protest even as the crackdown on the people who they protest for their basic needs. And this is, I think, a system cannot be justified with any modern human rights principles. Unfortunately, some of the countries in the Middle East have been using cultural relativism to explain that what Eleanor Roosevelt in 1948 as a Universal Declaration of Human Rights has introduced does not fit with their cultural perspectives. 22 Islamic countries in 1991, the foreign relations ministers, they get together and prepare Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam, which was not properly implemented as well at the beginning, at the start. It went to wane because it was a question. When we are talking a culture-based human rights, then what is the difference between Sharia-based human rights in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, in Afghanistan, and other countries? Which degree of religion, which principle, which school of thought within this Islamic will be the source of things? So universalism of human rights is disputed, and that's why these countries, they could not come to a common agreement that human rights, women's rights, minority rights, children's rights could be protected and preserved. So we have nothing other in the hand to force these countries who have a respect towards this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which has been introduced almost 70, 80 years ago and has been annually and every few years has been adding principles and set of laws to it, be it for minority, be it for political prisoners, for war, for children, for LGBT community, as well as for disability community members.
Thank you, Dr. Fridun. Really, I appreciate your points, particularly regarding the human rights in Sharia. There is lack of common understanding of human rights in these authoritarian regimes. There are two other points I would like to have your opinion on that. First is the role of those legal experts or legal activism under authoritarian regimes. How do you see, do they can survive in authoritarian system? Are there any compelling success stories of this? And also, what role do lawyers, human rights defenders, and scholars play in confronting authoritarianism and extremism?
Definitely, keeping quiet doesn't help anywhere around the world, especially the people in the Middle East and authoritarian systems. We have to speak up. We have to, as a human being, no matter if we are legal activists, political activists, we are human being, and we have the agency. We should show our social and political agency towards others. Martin Luther King once said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So that voice is helping us if we use it. We have to use our humanity, our human agency and social agency towards supporting other people. And the higher the level of the position and job, medical doctor, professor, teacher, engineer, we have more responsibility, and the most responsibility goes back to those ones that have been educated in human rights and laws and system of legislative systems to protect the people. So I believe we have a huge responsibility. And yes, these institutions, although they have been slowly pushing for change, but they have been very effective and they have been really acting, especially in countries like Turkey, Iran, Iraq, some of the other countries. I think the activists, they have been able to crack down on some of the violations or mechanism of surveillance by the regimes. I think they have been always using the surveillance, imprisonment, and torture as a mode of crackdown on the people. And this legal activists and human rights activists have been sometimes successful and in internationalizing this voice and bringing it to the international institutions like ICC and other organizations. We have seen it, for example, how Omar al-Bashir has come to the criminal court, or Milosevic in Yugoslavia in 1991 after a crackdown of Muslim women in Kosovo or Croatians or other minorities. How Milosevic has brought to justice by ICC and international organizations. And this has not been successful without the intervention of the local activists. We have seen in 1992 when the Kurdish Democratic Forces in a restaurant while discussing the situation of Iran have been terrorized by IRGC agents and terror agents of Islamic Republic of Iran, how this Mykonos process became a German court case and brought justice to the people, and at least the voices of these local activists were providing this German court with facts and documents how the violation of rights within the Islamic Republic has been working. And I think one problem here is the appeasement policies of the Western countries for their benefits and business relations, unfortunately, trying to shut down the voices of these local activists and lawyers. The appeasement policy, which I remember in 1989, when the Austrian Volkspartei or Christdemokrats have been sending back the terrorists from Vienna to Iran, and right after Cold War time, the president of the country also, unfortunately, for a while was a United Nations General Director, has built a business relationship with Iran just because appeasing their regimes by sending the terrorists and their terror agents. And these are the issues in international relations we see. But yes, I'm very proud. There are many activists. Unfortunately, there are many of them. They are in prison in Iran, in Turkey, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and many, many other countries, unfortunately, or Iraq. I think even Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries. But definitely, they have been able to voice the voice of the voiceless, the cry of the voiceless, and many things we hear around the world is just because of their activism and work. I working on a book is called Disappearance of Agency at the Age of War. And I explain how at the age of war and conflict, how the agency weakens. The people become more afraid, the crackdown on dissent is stronger, and the people, they become weaker in defending their neighbors or friends or people. And international community has to help, first of all, to prevent growth of this authoritarianism in the Middle East especially, and crackdown on their civil society, and help at least not appeasing these regimes and providing facilitation. I remember in 2011 when Mr. Obama came to power, at first he said, we will take our military out of Iraq. Right away, I remember I was at an American university, and I sent a letter to White House, one of the professors, manually taken it to Washington. And I asked President Obama, the way you're doing it right after taking down the Saddam Hussein, this will make a mess in Iraq. Taking the military forces out of Iraq right away just because of appeasing the regimes in the region, it will make a tribal conflict and abuse and violence. And we have seen it that 2011 ISIS came to the region, Iran came in Iraq, took control of the whole entire Syria, Iraq and parts of Lebanon, and wars and conflict started back down, and the dissent started, violation of rights became bigger, and this continued on.
Thank you, Dr. Freidun. You touched upon very key issues, particularly on those authoritarian regimes leaders, like you have mentioned Omar Bashir, Milosevic, and others, how the international law made them accountable. The system already have in this mechanism like ICC and ICG and others. Indeed, still there are some double dealing or double standards going by big powers towards these authoritarian regimes. Sometimes some of these regimes ignoring by the big powers. However, you have covered most of my questions in your last points. I would like to ask your message, particularly to the young generation in these totalitarian regimes, under the suppression of these totalitarian regimes, what they should do, what is their responsibility, how do they free themselves from these authoritarian regimes?
I'm very optimistic that the Middle East will take, may not even take 10 years or 50 years. It's for some of us, it might be a long time, but for globalized world, which is fast growing and developing and innovations are coming, AI, all technologies and social media. I think education system is changing, the access to resources is changing, and the people's understanding and globalized mind is establishing. I think in these developments and technological changes in the world is helping us to better catch up with new things and access to some of the at least knowledge and technologies and access to resources as well. I suggest the young generations to educate themselves more. I suggest that people, they should become a member of civic organizations, civic society, and institutions. But the institutions like yours is great endeavor which can bring not only the knowledge and understanding towards what's going on in the Middle East and authoritarian regimes, but rather makes hope and bring better grasp towards actively for improvement of life. Don't forget that one of the issues authoritarianism is degradation of quality of life. As many scholars have mentioned, and the quality of life under the suppression and political tribalism and abuse and violence through authoritarianism, it's worse living conditions for the people and worsening and degrading the level of living within the population. So we have to fight this back, this kind of a format of authoritarian. Authoritarianism is not good for environment. Authoritarianism is not good for entire world. So we have to come to an understanding that we give our hands together and fight wherever injustices around the world is, be it in Hazara in Afghanistan, be it in Pashtun, be it in Balochistan, be it in Kurdistan, be it in Afghanistan or, in other countries around the world, we have to speak up and work together. One. The second thing is the culture change. Culture change doesn't come. It's slow. But with the globalized world, it can be faster towards modernity and modernism. Modern thinking, plural society, equity, diversity, inclusion, and affirmative action rules within the administrative systems. And this happening through education. We have to educate ourselves, not only the legal education, but general education as well, about the environment, about the women, about the religions, of freedom of religions, freedom of speech. Even you want to change your religion, that's your personal utmost responsibility and right, and nobody has to crack down. Legal education, human rights education is fundamental where we are working. If you are a medical doctor, talk about it. If you see something is abusive, just stop it. If you can't stop it, at least criticize it. Critical thinking is the most important things that the youth and young generation they have to understand. Legal mobilization is another item. The legal mobilization, we have to take action wherever we see abuse and injustice, be it in a democratic country like France, is forcing a girl to take off the scarf, or in a non-democratic country, forcing a young Iranian girl to forcefully cover the face and cover the hair. No matter wherever this is happening, we have to take the legal action. We have to do mobilization. We have to speak up. We have to show our agency. And this doesn't happen till we communicate together. We build up the front of civic organization and civic society. critical pedagogy in the schools has to start, universities, comparative legal analysis within the researcher. We have to see why constitution in Afghanistan is not working, why constitution in Iran has gone away, why in Turkey has been destructed, why in Sweden and Norway and other countries is working, why we are not adapting some of those human-based regulations and laws within our system. I think there are many tools today. I remember 1979 when 12 young activists in my small Kurdish town in airport were massacred by Ayatollah Khomeini's agent, Khalkhali. Not even 10 people around the world knew about it. Till recent, when the pictures through the globalized world and social media published in recent years. But nowadays, any abuse and violence anywhere around the corner can make explosive attention and irritation within the world. And this doesn't happen till we act, we work together, and we believe all from the bottom of our heart that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. This is education. This is human rights education, and this is legal education.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fridun Rahmani, for being with us in this podcast.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Take care.